police try to clear the heavy backlog of Jacksonville's unsolved murders. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9 and now subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, we'll take your calls on the city's cold cases. Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, important health news to prevent and detect brain aneurysms. Plus, a look ahead to a Labor Day tradition on the First Coast, the Great Ponte Vedra Paddle. All of that ahead this morning, but first this hour, police records show there are around 1,300 unsolved murders here in Jacksonville dating back to 1970. The city has roughly the same number of unsolved murders as the entire state of Colorado. As WJCT's Lindsay Kilbred reports, some people here on the First Coast are working to change investigation procedures and offer support to victims' families.
Barry Brooks Jr. was 19 when he was killed.
He was our go-getter. I would say if you did not know BJ at the beginning of an event, you knew him at the end of an event, because he was the one that stood out.
BJ's mom, Margie Brooks, remembers 2007. Her son was a lifeguard, dance instructor, worked in after-school programs.
Here he is when he's got his students standing on their heads. He's teaching them how to break dance.
That looks painful.
It does.
She's looking through a huge photo album. And picture after picture, BJ has the biggest smile.
Here's another one of him. And this was 08. This was his students. But that's minus him because he was killed.
BJ was murdered in Jacksonville on the evening of November 19th, 2007. His father, Barry Brooks, says earlier that day their house was flooded from some work JEA had been doing, but BJ stepped up.
But we were back at the house doing what we can to salvage what we can. And it was my niece's birthday at the same time. He called and said that he was headed over that way.
Barry says BJ went to the birthday party, took all the cousins to visit their grandmother, and stopped to change a family member's flat tire. That night, he went to a friend's apartment about a half mile down Temecuana Road. He was outside when two guys robbed him and stole his cross necklace.
And the other guy pulled out a gun and shot him in the side.
They said he bled to death. They couldn't stop the bleeding.
His mom and dad pulled up at the hospital at the same time as BJ's ambulance.
And sometimes I still think I should have just yelled out one last time, BJ, I love you. Mommy and Daddy are here.
You know, you don't believe it. You want to think that they had the wrong person.
Barry says investigators seemed confident at first, told them they had DNA evidence and that they were going to find these guys.
Then you realize that they don't have anything to go on. And before you know it, they call on you and they telling you that they can't pursue it no more. They can't spend the man hours. And
today, BJ's case is suspended. That means there aren't any more leads to go on, so investigators have to just wait. Wait for someone to come forward with new information. Ryan Backman knows this feeling. His father was killed on the South Side in 2009, and his case is suspended too.
They feel like nobody cares.
Backman started an organization called Project Cold Case to advocate for families like the Brookses.
I want to be that bridge between a frustrated family and a detective that I know is doing their best.
Backman is also working on making a statewide database of the cases, something that doesn't exist anywhere else. And he's working with Jacksonville Senator Aaron Bean on legislation. Bean's bill would create a task force to help standardize cold case investigation procedures across local law enforcement agencies. On Sunday afternoon, it's raining on the west side. It's been almost 8 years since BJ Brooks was murdered. His parents still live in the same house. They just recently changed his bedroom.
They were moving the clothes out of the drawers and all of his things. That was hard.
People say life goes on, but for me, life stopped.
Barry Brooks says he can't help but feel like investigators gave up on BJ's case. Lindsay Kilbride, WJCT News.
here to discuss the city's cold cases. Now, we welcome our own Lindsay Kilbride. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also in studio, Ryan Backman, founder and executive director of Project Cold Case. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Chief Tom Hackney. He's been a detective, supervisor in homicide, which includes a cold case unit, now head of investigations with the JSO. Chief Hackney, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you.
We'll go to your calls in just a moment on Jacksonville's cold cases. What are your questions and thoughts? 549-2937. That's 549-2937, or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect, email and tweet us. Chief Hackney, let's begin with you, and Lindsay, jump in. The end of her excellent piece about when you hear that, as you've worked so hard on these cases over the years, when you hear the families say they feel like JSO's given up, I know you've worked really hard on these over the years. How does that hit you?
It touches you because truly, as an investigator, you know in your heart that you're not stopping until you've done everything that you can. And you just hope that the victims' families in these cases just have an appreciation for that, knowing that there are limited things that can be done with both technology and cases in general. You do everything you can, but there does sometimes reach that point that there is an end, if you will.
Lindsay, and that's what you learned in reporting this, that yeah. There are lots of families out there like the one that you talked to.
You know, I've spoken to a lot of families. I, you know, made a whole documentary about cold cases when I was up in Maine, and all the families I speak to, you hear the same thing, which is, well, what about my child or my loved one? You know, I mean, investigators can do everything they're going to do, even if they're doing a great job. If you're the one case that hasn't been solved, you don't feel like justice is brought to you. So, I mean, you're always going to feel a little upset about that.
Ryan Backman, you founded Project Cold Case based here in Jacksonville, but it has a national scope. Can you tell us why?
I absolutely can. I started in Jacksonville because that's where my dad's case was. It's where most of the people I have worked with as an advocate I've met and are in Jacksonville. And I started Project Cold Case with the idea that we would begin a database in Jacksonville because I had a relationship with JSO and it would be an easy place to start. And then I got the first request from a family across the country and they said, will you feature my loved one? And I wasn't going to say no because I know what that's like to feel like there's nobody out there that really cares anymore. There's nobody out there that's looking and that everybody has forgotten. And so I decided right then that while I would start in Jacksonville and move out throughout the state and then on, that anybody that would submit a case that I could confirm through the appropriate law enforcement agency in another state, I would include on my website.
And you're working to sort of, as you said, bridge the gap between investigators like Chief Hackney and families. How do you go about that?
Well, there's a lot of frustration on the family's ends, and a lot of it is really misunderstanding and miscommunication. There is somebody to blame for all of these murders and all of these unsolved murders. It's not the people with the badge. They're not the ones that did it. They're not the ones that should, but they bear the brunt of the frustration. And that's part of their job, they'll tell you. But I think there's a better way. I think somebody like me at the table who understands the hurt and pain of losing someone, but can appreciate how hard detectives work and what they've done for this community and other communities, I think that I can help bridge that gap.
We'll go to your calls on the city's cold cases in just a moment at 549-2937. Chief Tom Hackney, what do you see as the biggest challenges for JSO to try to clear this backlog?
It's, you know, we solve these murders by cooperation in so many times. And when you start talking about cold case, I'm always happy to talk about cold case murder investigations because any light that we're shining on a cold case is a good light. And, you know, the time being the double-edged sword that it is, time passes and sometimes people forget and, you know, technology may change. But on the other side of that sword, that time that passes may be just enough time that somebody who knows something is willing to step forward. You know, times changed in their lives. That may be just enough for them to want to come forward. Technology changes, DNA changes, all those things can be beneficial. And the talking about it and shining the light on it and bringing it up is maybe, I know that based on the nearly 1,300 that we have back to 1970, there's a lot of people walking around the streets of Jacksonville who have information about those 1,300 cases. The people that commit these crimes, they talk. We know it from the ones we solve, and they talk to these people that are out there with their friends and their families, and just those people need to come forward and share that little bit of information. In so many cases here, you could be just one little step away, one little piece of information away to us having one fewer unsolved case.
And if you know anything about a cold case, you should call in right now. That's what we're talking about on the show this morning. Give us a call, 549-2937. Steve, along Beach Boulevard. Hey, Steve, thanks for holding. Good morning. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Melissa. I'm calling in reference to the murder of John L. Johnson in May of 2015 at an after-school prom party where 30 people were at the party and witnessed, many witnesses to the murder, and no shooter's name has been mentioned, no arrests have been made. And I'm just curious, here's something where it was pretty evident that they know who the shooter is, and nothing's been done to make an arrest.
Do you know who the shooter is?
No, I don't. I'd love to know. I'd love to know who the shooter is. No, but it blows my mind that there were 30 kids at this party, and there were witnesses to the murder that the Florida Times Union reported that the kids at the party knew who the shooter was, and yet there's been no name released or no arrest made.
All right. Steve, thanks for the call. Chief Hackney, over the years, we've interviewed investigators at JSO about this so many times, this whole idea of the no-snitch culture where people don't want to tell the police what they know. That's tough for you guys. I know it is.
It absolutely is. You know, in this particular case, you did have quite a few people who were there who were witnesses to a portion or a part of this murder that occurred, and that's some of the frustration that we have when we're dealing with this. It's similar to the old party game where you start telling something, and by the time it gets back to the other side of the room, the story is completely different, and that's some of the hurdles that we're facing in that particular murder case that he mentioned there. But again, this is early into this, and we've still got a lot of work that we can do with that. But there are limitations to that, and of course, you know, our partnership that we have with the state attorney's office and Angela Corey as a state attorney is just unparalleled. The cooperation that we get from them and their involvement in these murders, from being in our scenes all the way through, it just makes such a great difference. But there again, they have to have an expectation that they're going to get a guilty verdict in these cases. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's what we're all working for.
Ryan Backman, I'm sure you share some of the same frustration as that caller. You feel that somebody knows about who killed your family member.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. These people are criminals. They get away with it once. Typically, they either try again or they're going to tell somebody about it. The real fear is there seems to be a culture of, as long as it doesn't impact my life, then I'm not going to get involved. But then the second it impacts somebody else's life, they're the ones calling for their neighbors and friends to come forward.
Lindsay Kilbride, we also need to point out that the National Public Radio Program Reveal is going to take a look at this as a national issue next week.
Yep. There's a show about it. I think it's about some of the longest, some of the cold cases that have been going on for the longest.
Right. Some of the most difficult ones to solve. And if you're just tuning in, as we speak with Chief Tom Hackney of the JSO, Ryan Backman, founder of Project Cold Case, and our own Lindsay Kilbride, hundreds of cold cases in Jacksonville that investigators still want to solve. They need your help. And if you have a thought, a comment, even a tip, we want you to call us right now. The number to join the show is 549-2937. Keith in Riverside. Hi, Keith. Good morning. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Good morning. You know, if you have 100% failure rate in the 30 or so witnesses that come forward, that's a pretty good indication that you've got a relationship deficit between the police and the community. And blaming the people that don't come forward because they don't feel safe, I mean, that's convenient for the sheriff's office or the investigators. But you have to look internally and understand why people are reluctant to come forward. What has their interaction with the law enforcement agencies and the state attorney's office been? I'm not saying that there is 100%, you know, negative relationship, but something is wrong if people don't feel safe coming forward. and it isn't necessarily the people.
Keith, thanks for the call. Chief Hackney, what about his comments?
Yeah, I can certainly assure that we are nowhere in 100% bracket of people not coming forward. So many of these cases that we do solve, and our clearance rate is above the national average and has been for numerous years. And it's greatly in part because of that citizen involvement, because people aren't afraid. You know, you hear about this don't snitch, and you mentioned it before. Some of that is not exactly what it appears to be. We do get a lot of people calling, and some of it's anonymous, and I'm happy to take information from any source, anonymous included. But to characterize it as 100%, and that's just not the case.
And here are some phone numbers for folks to call in to learn about a cold case or give a tip. 630-0500 or Crime Stoppers. That number is 1-866-845-TIPS. And I know we're throwing a lot of phone numbers at you right now, everybody, but the number to call us is 549-2937. Let's go to Dan in Jacksonville. Hey, Dan, how are you today?
I'm fine. I'm calling about, you know, this is in relation to my uncle that was killed back in 1932. His name was William Turner, and they blamed it on an escaped convict out of Georgia, which the detectives in Florida arrested down here. But they never charged the individual with murder of my uncle or anything like that because they said he was already doing a life sentence. Okay. Well, 3 years later, they released this man. And because they said he was doing a life sentence for killing a policeman. But why did they release him 3 years later? Why didn't they charge him with my uncle's death?
Dan, thanks for the call. Ryan Backman.
I mean, in situations like that, you know, there's a number of reasons why something like that may have happened back then. I don't think you would see that same situation now. Of course, Chief Hackney would probably be better to talk about that.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that we're talking 80-some years ago. Yeah. But you know what? Hearing someone call in about a case from the 30s, that shows you how deep the pain goes and how long these things can go on and how many decades they can affect a family.
This is just a classic example. And you know, sitting here with Ryan today, this is as fresh today for Ryan, as I'm sure, as it was the day he was notified about his father's death. And I was involved in that back then. And here we go for something that many years ago.
From the
30s.
Yeah.
It doesn't stop. For these families that are impacted from murder are never the same families that they were the day before the murders. And as investigators, please know that touches us the same way. It's an odd predicament when you're investigating a murder. You learn so much about the victim who you're investigating, and it's somebody you've will never meet, never have a chance to know, but you know intimate details about them and their life and their demise. And it touches investigators, but no matter how much it touches, we will never know how Ryan feels.
Lindsay Kilbride, let's talk for a minute about some new movement on this, in addition to what Ryan and the JSO have been working on. The Florida Sheriff's Association announced the creation of a cold case review team just last month. Also, State Senator Aaron Bean has introduced legislation to try to look at this. Let's bring listeners up to date on that.
Yeah, and Ryan has been heavily involved in this legislation with Aaron Bean. He's been the main person putting this bill in. Is that right? Yeah. So the bill's changed significantly over the last few years. Originally, they wanted it to include a task force, also this team of people who would review the cases, and also a database. But now, because of some lack of interest, some lack of not, you know, the bill not going in and passing all everything, they have it now submitted. They submitted it about 6 days ago, I think, Aaron Bean did. And it's a bill that would enact a task force review team. Of people who would look at the best practices, policies, procedures for investigating cold cases. So he's hoping to get that in. But the Florida Sheriff's Association, they did, they're beginning a review team. So it's right. A quarterly review team. They'll look at cases, new cases every time.
549-2937. Lots of calls this morning on the city's hundreds of cold cases. Loretta is in Orange Park right now. Hey, Loretta, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing all right, thanks. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I have a situation where y'all was talking about, you know, people not wanting to snitch or whatever. I feel like 2 years ago, the boys that were killed at the Golden Corral on Normandy Boulevard, I had personally went to the Clay County Sheriff's Office a week prior to that happening and told them that the boy who did that had shot a kid in the face at a party in Clay County. Why was he still free a week later to kill two kids? And I had did my part. I had went and done. You know, I knew what had happened. I wasn't at the party, but I had gotten back to me. I told him who he was, gave him everything about him, and yet he was still out a week later to kill two more kids. So, I mean, that's kind of like, I mean, we feel like you're not moving fast enough in a situation like that.
Loretta, thanks for the call. Chief Tom Hackney, we're getting a lot of emotional calls this morning.
I get it. I truly do. There is much emphasis placed on the investigators, as myself as a chief of detectives, that, listen, time is of the essence. You don't know what – I mean, these people are capable of their crimes, and I don't want to leave them out there any longer than need be, because who knows what they're capable of next. And that is some of the pressure that we feel. But just know that, you know, we have a case that we've made an arrest on a couple of years ago. It was a 1984 case where 10-year-old Tammy Welch was killed off of 103rd Street. And it was the first day of school, and she missed school. And, you know, advances in technology in that particular case led us to the suspect, made an arrest, and we're still working towards a trial and hopefully a guilty verdict in that particular case. But, you know, that's a case from 84 that we don't stop, although, you know, we talk about suspended cases and those kind of things. When new information comes up and DNA that's been submitted to the combined DNA index system, the CODIS system, you know, when we get a new hit on that, that takes a case from a suspended status and brings it back out. And there's a whole lot of opportunity to move some of these cases forward. But we do know time is of the essence.
Gordon along the Dames Point Bridge. Hey, Gordon. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, Melissa. I have a question for the detective. Actually, a couple of questions. Number one, is it not a crime to not report a murder? And number two, the case that was brought up earlier of the show with the guy at a prom party that was killed and there were 30 kids at the party, can't somebody be charged as an accomplice for not coming forward? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks. Great show today.
Thank you, Gordon. I guess we need to ask our chief again.
Long and short is yes, it is a crime to certainly not report a murder. And there's a lot of associated crimes that are with that, with disposing of a body that if we need be, can be utilized in investigating and trying to hold those responsible for these. And again, here you are at a thing where you have 30 some odd witnesses, and some of the hiccups are with that if you don't have everybody who sees something similar and people see a portion or a part of an incident that occurred, that doesn't help towards, again, that successful prosecution that we're trying to get to.
Here's a comment on our Facebook page, Lindsay from JP. Is this backlog a result of too few man hours or dollars allocated? What can we do about that? When you look at this, you made a comparison between the number of murders in Duval as compared to the entire state of Colorado. Does the way Florida approaches this differ from other states? And does the national show Reveal look at that?
You know, I don't know exactly how Colorado approaches this. I know that the legislation that Ryan is a proponent of is based off of legislation in Colorado, so they are making efforts toward it. But when you look at the populations, Colorado has about 5.3 million people. Jacksonville has, 850,000. So, I mean, it is pretty significant that our city would have, you know, a similar number. And I think the thing about it with the legislation for a task force is that would look at the best policies and procedures. And the thing is, like, every agency has their own way of doing things. So to identify the best ways would be the idea behind that. So.
Ryan.
Yeah, we brought this legislation up because There's a lot of good law enforcement agencies out there, and somebody has to have a better way. There's always a better way. And if we're not looking to get better, then we're getting worse as a community as well. So that's all we wanted to do, was take a look at what agencies are doing and figure out what's the best approach, and then maybe try to make that a uniform approach across the entire state.
Let's try to get a few more calls. AJ is in Arlington. Hey, AJ, good morning to you. What are your thoughts?
Hey, Melissa, Ryan, and Chief Hackney. How
hey,
y'all
AJ.
Doing?
Yeah.
I would like for Chief Hackney to talk about building the trust in the community and what the police are going to do moving forward to help with that. Because I know being in Mad Dads, we are out in the community a lot talking to the citizens. We've already been out with the sheriff a couple of times this year. And I know if we have trust, more of the community will come forward with cold cases and current cases that we are dealing with right now. I just want to know what the sheriff's office is going to continue to do.
Thanks, AJ. And by the way, here's a tweet from Sandy for you, Chief. It says, Chief Hackney's passion for the victims is clearly evident. Truly appreciated. Thanks for all you do.
Well, thanks for that. And, yeah. and it's true. You don't do this job and do it for any length of time where you don't feel that touch with the victims, and you want to do everything you can. That's why you get into this job. To address AJ's comment, you can't start building relationships in crisis. And I can tell you with both Sheriff Rutherford and Sheriff Williams, that working with the community, getting out in the community when things aren't going bad is so critical, and working with groups, Mad Dads and other groups that get out there in the community and help us bridge the gaps that may exist. Hey, that's so critical, so crucial. It will continue on. I mean, Sheriff Williams from the very beginning has really gotten out there and tried to work with that, and I know that will continue.
Yeah, that he's really made that a priority, it seems. Yeah. Let's take one more call. John in St. Augustine. Hi, John. How are you today?
Hi. Doing well. How are you guys?
Okay. Go ahead.
I've lived in Jacksonville area for about 12 years now, and, you know, I'm not directly involved with any victim. I've been pretty free from crime while I live here, but I care about Jacksonville. I love the city. You know, I definitely call it home, and I want to know what I can do to help, you know, in cases like this. What can I do to get involved and help with cold cases?
Sure. Thanks, John. Ryan, great question.
Yeah. You know, we have always had a hard time getting people unaffected to care. And you know, it's natural. Before I was affected, it was not my type priority either. But we need people that are unaffected to come forward. I heard a lot of people say, you know, there's a trust issue, but this goes beyond, you know, talking about these cases goes beyond trust with law enforcement. You need to look inside yourself and do the right thing, period. Whether JSO is going to back you, whether they're going to make an arrest the next day. But as a citizen, you know, at Project Cold Case, we post these cases every week. We post a cold case spotlight. And our goal with that is for these cases to be shared on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, because we need one person to see that and come forward, one person that has information. And we've had cases where 30,000 people have been reached on social media. We don't need 30,000, we need one. But the way to get to that one is through 30,000. So if you're a citizen and you care about this community, share this information with social media, talk about it, be aware of your surroundings, develop a relationship with your local law enforcement agencies. Chief Hackney and I have met a number of times. We've not always seen eye to eye because I'm looking at it from a victim perspective and he's looking at it from an investigator perspective. But that doesn't mean there's not trust there. That means there's a lot of room for us to compromise and come together and work together to make this community a better place.
Yeah. So for John who just called, the website is projectcoldcase.org. It says right here, I'm looking at the homepage, this week's cold case spotlight is Franklin Prince Jr. of Jacksonville. He was killed on December 23rd, 2007. So anyone who's listening, as Ryan said, tweet this, Facebook, Instagram, share this information, help the police solve some of these cases. And we thank you all so much for being here in studio. Such an important topic. Thanks for giving us your time this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chief Tom Hackney is the head of investigations with the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. Ryan Backman is the founder and executive director of Project Cold Case. Our own WJCT reporter Lindsay Kilbride has covered the issue. You can access her story at WJCTnews.org. And next Thursday, September 10th at 1 o'clock p.m., tune into the acclaimed investigative program Reveal for a look into America's cold cases. You can hear that right here on 89.9. Well, much more still ahead. Later, it's your chance to try stand-up paddleboarding, a preview of the Great Ponte Vedra Paddle coming up. But up next, detecting a potentially deadly condition, cerebral aneurysm. That's in a moment.
Hello, I'm Steve Woodard, the Director of Emergency Preparedness for the City of Jacksonville. Knowing your evacuation zone is critical to your safety. Listen to emergency management for important evacuation information. And stay informed at jacksready.com and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
Join us for the radio variety show that celebrates the culture, art, and history of Northeast Florida.
Wake up in the morning, yeah.
Swamp Radio features musicians, poets, playwrights, and interviews that tell the unique story of our home.
My idea was to take them to the epicenter of Southern cooking, the Waffle House.
What you do best is most everything.
Swamp Radio, Friday evening at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Follow what's happening at WJCT, even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT-FM at wjct.org/listen, or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT-FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First is proud to present the 4th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire teachers. Saturday, September 12th at the Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Tickets are only $30. Spend the day sharing ideas with colleagues, learning new ways to engage students, and empowering yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
Welcome back. Well, a quick programming note. Tomorrow, First Coast Connect will be live and on the go from the nation's oldest city. For the full hour, we'll be broadcasting live from downtown St. Augustine as they gear up for their 450th commemorations. We'll speak to the city's mayor, organizers of the big event, and a lot of other interesting people. It's one big party in historic St. Augustine, and we're bringing it to you live. So tune in and stop by and see us near the Pirate Museum, near the Castillo de San Marcos. That's First Coast Connect on the go, live from St. Augustine tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Well, in health news this morning, every year, approximately 40,000 patients in this country suffer from a ruptured cerebral aneurysm. And up to 6% of the population may have an unruptured cerebral aneurysm. Now, aneurysms occur when there's a weak or a thin spot on a blood vessel in the brain that balloons out and fills with blood. Identifying them early is critical. September is National Brain Aneurysm Awareness Month. Right now, to tell us all about it, we welcome Dr. Eric Sauvageau, neurovascular surgeon with Lyerly Neurosurgery and Baptist Health. He's one of the directors of the Stroke and Cerebrovascular Center, Baptist Medical Center here in Jacksonville. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
That was a mouthful, by the way. I'm glad I got that out. You know, this is an important topic because this can really strike without warning. It can really be a shocking thing for a patient to have happen to them.
Absolutely. So unfortunately, most people who have brain aneurysm are not aware of it. And the first sign frequently will be an acute onset headache. So most people will describe that as the worst headache of their life. They'll have nausea with it, vomiting, pain in the back of their neck. And obviously, unfortunately, 15 to 20% of people will die almost at the onset when the aneurysm rupture. But there's the lucky one, the aneurysm will stop bleeding immediately. And then obviously, if they seek medical care right away, we could fix the aneurysm before they have a more devastating consequence.
So a terrible headache and nausea are the typical symptoms. Anything else?
So people could have pain behind the eye. If people start seeing double, those could be other sign. The other thing that is important to keep in mind is that, as you mentioned earlier, about 4 to 6% of population have a brain aneurysm. We know that the risk double if there is aneurysm that runs in the family. So if there's people in the family who have brain aneurysm, obviously the risk of having an aneurysm is higher, and it's probably worth it to investigate those patients to make sure that they don't have a brain aneurysm. And if they do, there's many things that could be done to fix those aneurysms, which really, really low risk now.
What are some things we can do? If there's a genetic component to this, how can we determine if we're at risk and how can we protect ourselves?
So the easiest thing is to, look in the family if there's anybody else that had a brain aneurysm or in the past, sometimes the diagnosis was not made. But if somebody in the family dies suddenly and it was unclear exactly or there was a brain bleed, that could be something that trigger concern and that warrant investigation. One of the thing as well, it's really important that, someone could do to prevent an aneurysm rupturing to develop a brain aneurysm is to quit smoking.
The number one risk factor beyond genetics?
Correct. The number one modifiable risk factor.
So at the Stroke Center at Baptist, there are some new treatments you wanted to talk about, correct?
Absolutely. So at Baptist and at Wolfson, fortunately, there's less children that have brain aneurysm than adult, but unfortunately, it still happened. And we sure provide care at Wolfson also. There is the conventional treatment, which is doing a craniotomy, so an opening in the skull and put a little clamp on this ballooning of the artery. So it's called clipping. And until the 90s, that was the way that was more frequently used. Fortunately, now the field is moving towards more minimally invasive approach, and it's rarer and rarer that we need to do an opening in the skull. There's now a little coil, little filament that we could bring within the artery and fill the aneurysm with. And there's a lot of new technology that are now available. There's a lot of technology that are currently investigated by the FDA. We're fortunate to be part of all those initial trials that look at those new technology, those little stent, those little mesh that we put within the aneurysm to fill the aneurysm with. And so this way we prevent bleeding from the aneurysm.
And there are other studies being done too as well, correct?
Absolutely. So And as I mentioned, we're fortunate enough to be part of all those study to investigate really newer way to treat those aneurysm. So this way, the treatment is less morbid, and people just give you an idea. It's not infrequent now that someone will get an aneurysm that has not ruptured, will be treated, and will leave the hospital the following day.
That's a big leap forward, isn't it?
Definitely.
It never used to be that way.
Absolutely not.
So what's the difference between today and, say, 20 years ago in terms of the survival rate?
So for people who have a brain aneurysm that rupture, the mortality remains significant because there's a lot of people that unfortunately will die right away and there's not much we could do for. But on the survival, there's a lot more that could be done. And on people that we detect the aneurysm before it bleeds, the odds of everything going well is overwhelmingly positive. And, 98% of people will go through treatment and should not have any complication from the aneurysm being fixed.
Anything else people should be aware of?
Again, anything, it's like stroke symptoms, anything that is different, new kind of pain, acute, something that, someone who has a migraine, who's been having the same migraine for 20 years, obviously this is not as concerning as somebody who has no headache, start having a new kind of headache or acute onset headache. That's something to be concerned about.
Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. September is National Brain Aneurysm Awareness Month. He's Dr. Eric Sauvageau of the Stroke and Cerebrovascular Center at Baptist here in Jacksonville. And we are back in a moment.
Thank you. on the next Fresh Air, how our understanding of autism has changed over the decades and how certain myths about autism caught on. We talk with science writer Steve Silberman, author of the new book Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Jonathan Franzen's new novel, Purity. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Big day at the job. Make it break time. They're all waiting for you right now in the conference room. Well, they're going to have to wait because you're not leaving the radio until you hear the end of that story. Snap Judgment from NPR. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT. Listeners love Relax Radio.
Hi, I'm Evan Willman. I typically listen to the station when I'm in my my home office. I work out of my house a lot. I have my HD radio in there. So this is really the best of all worlds. It gives me my news. It gives me music that constantly delights and surprises me.
When you make a $120 gift to WJCT, you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to Relax. Call 904-353-9528 for more information.
WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to announce that Mary Enworth will be this year's morning keynote speaker at Teach. Mary is co-author of Pathways to the Common Core. She is deputy director of middle schools at the Teachers Reading and Writing Project, Columbia University. Mary is just one of the many great speakers you will hear throughout the day. For more information or to purchase tickets, go to WJCT/teach.
Well, finally this hour, it has become a great Labor Day tradition here on the First Coast. The Great Ponte Vedra Paddle is a way to get out and try stand-up paddle boarding and at the same time help local kids on the autism spectrum. Here to tell us about it, we welcome the founder of the Great Ponte Vedra Paddle, Dana Current. He's a board member, and Chris Spires, he is the board president of HEAL, the Heal Autism Now Foundation. Guys, it's great to see you. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Now, in a moment, we'll talk about the mission of Heal. But first, Dana, let's talk about the tradition of this. This has gotten bigger every year. You came up with this. How did this all come about? Let's talk about how this all started.
Sure. Well, like any good idea, it came up around the kitchen table. We've been looking for an event on a holiday at the beaches in Ponte Vedra. You know, around town, we've got some great other events. You've got Dancing in the Streets. You've got the Shrimp Festival in Fernandina. You've got Springing in the Blues. There was really nothing on any major holiday in Ponte Vedra. And this was a great way to have people get out. And what do you want to do on Labor Day? Let's go to the beach. And so it was a great way to fit with what a growing sport is stand-up paddleboarding.
Right. It's sort of like a nice way to end the summer and try a really growing sport. Enjoy the ocean. And this is for all levels. If you've never even done paddleboarding, you can get out and do this, right?
Exactly. Very easy. So we have a 1 mile paddle, which, you know, our tagline used to be, even grandma can do it, but it's really quite easy, and you can get out, and if you don't have a paddleboard, we have a lot of outfitters that can get you set up that day or the day before to make sure that you've got something to get out there on.
And Chris Spires, this benefits a great organization that you and I are both involved with, HEAL. The HEAL Foundation helps families and children who families with children on the autism spectrum.
Correct. Families here in Northeast Florida, all the money that we raise for HEAL go back into the local community. And over the last 3 years, Dana and his team have raised over $100,000. This year, we're hoping that the event's going to be even bigger and better, and it's looking that way.
Yeah, it really has grown every year, and it's been so gratifying to see how families have been helped, because people might not realize how expensive and how challenging autism spectrum disorders are. And families are impacted in so many ways. It's a tough road for families.
It is, and the foundation helps support camps in the summer. you know, so the kids can get out and do a surf camp and just for the day to get out and have the families and have the mothers be able to do other things. It's really tremendous. We have a zoo walk in the spring. And again, we have about 1,000 families and children that come out and participate and experience that. So mm-hmm. This past year, we were able to put 150 iPads in Duval County. So the money that we're raising, we're putting right back into the community.
You know, Dana, it's been incredible to see the co-founder of HEAL, Leslie Weed. She and her husband, Bobby Weed, have a daughter on the autism spectrum who was nonverbal, Lanier. And through the use of an iPad, she has, for the first time, she has become able to communicate with other people. It has just been miraculous.
It's truly amazing what we see. I can tell you that most of us know someone, a family, a friend that has a child with autism. And so it's very wide. 1 in 4 boys now are diagnosed with autism. That's a tremendous number that a lot of people don't realize. And the difficulty that puts on a family financially, emotionally, mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that go into it that people don't realize. And a lot of it isn't covered by regular insurance. So raising money for HEAL was a wonderful opportunity for us to, provide things back to this 5-county area. We go into South Georgia, mm-hmm. all of North Florida, and the money all stays here. 100% of the proceeds from our events go to the autism community.
Yeah, because, Chris, for kids to even just go to a child on the autism spectrum, to even just go to a camp is such a big deal, because so often, particularly with boys on the autism spectrum, they have trouble socially interacting with other kids, and a lot of camps might not even allow them to go. And so for them to even go to a summer camp and have that experience is such an enormous thing for a family. It's hard to even express emotionally what that means for families to have their kids be able to have these experiences.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think, you really see it when you do have the children out there, whether it's the surf camps or some of the other programs that we put on, and we match them up with counselors. So there's some one-on-one that really helps the experience with the kids, and it is really nice to see.
Now, Dana, you founded the Great Ponte Vedra Paddle. I've never seen you out there. How good are you at this?
Well, I didn't start paddleboarding until maybe 4 or 5 years ago, but uh-huh. there's a lot of people that have really gotten into the sport. I'm not that great, but
I think you're being modest. I tried to go out in the ocean one time, and we picked a day when the surf was really up, and oh my gosh, it was a lot harder than I thought. I should have picked a calmer day, but I don't want people to be intimidated, because they shouldn't be scared off by from trying this, right?
Absolutely not. We're praying for flat seas and low winds and a pretty sunny day, which we've had the last 3 years, so we're going to have that again this year.
Now, this is going to start bright and early on Monday morning, Labor Day, Michler's Landing. People need to get there early, because parking fills up, right? Any other tips for folks?
No, get there early. If there's room in the parking lot, obviously park there in the parking lot. We do have parking across the street in the shopping plaza. And we had a question the other day about what do I do with my board? So we've arranged for board caddies. So you can pull up, drop off your board. They'll take it down to the beach for you, make it very convenient. Go park your car and come in and get your registration packet and get ready to paddle.
It is the Great Ponte Vedra Paddle coming up on Labor Day at Michler's Landing. Hundreds will come out to support people with autism on the First Coast. Founder Dana Current and Chris Spires, both with the HEAL Foundation. So appreciate you both being with us. Thanks so much for spreading the word here. We really appreciate it.
Thanks,
Melissa.
So again, that website is greatpvpaddle.org. Get out and support that great organization. And again, a quick programming note. We won't be in studio tomorrow. We'll be live and on the go, live from St. Augustine, as we bring you a full hour of interesting guests from the nation's oldest city as St. Augustine gears up for its 450th commemorations. Come on down and see us from the city's Pirate Museum near the historic Castillo. It's going to be a very interesting show, First Coast Connect, live and on the go tomorrow from 9 to 10 a.m. And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. The show producer is Sean Birch. Our theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Questions or comments, send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and make sure to subscribe to that daily podcast. It's on iTunes and Stitcher. Next on Die in Rheims, the Austria-Hungary border has become the latest pressure point in Europe's ongoing migrant crisis. An update on the huge influx of migrants and refugees from the Middle East and Africa and the future of open borders within the EU. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be live and on the go from St. Augustine tomorrow. See you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.